from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Journalist and author Mark Hertzgard joins us next to talk about his newest book, Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, which focuses on the 2 billion young people who will be facing global changes over the next half century, which Mark Hertzgard calls the second era of global warming. His book tells of his despair and concern about climate change, but also his hope and belief in solutions. Forum is next with your calls, emails, and your online questions and comments. After this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum program. Mark Hertzgard has been writing about issues related to climate change for the past 2 decades, but what he wondered would imminent changes mean for his young daughter and the children contending with the next half century of global changes, what he calls the second era of global warming. Arguing for a green Apollo program and citing examples of promising innovations, he tells us we must somehow learn, quote, to avoid the unmanageable and manage the unavoidable. Author of 5 other books, including On Bended Knee, The Press and the Reagan Presidency, and Earth Odyssey, Around the World in Search of Our Environmental Future, Mark Hertzgard joins us in studio for this forum hour, and good to see you again. Welcome.
Always good to be here, Michael.
Well, where do we begin with this? Let's talk about the inspiration of this book. It's your daughter.
Be careful. I could talk the entire hour.
Well, you're a proud, loving parent. That goes without saying. But it was just, I guess, thinking about, I guess she was 6 years old, Kara, at the time, right? And you're thinking, what?
No. She was 5 months old when I had the epiphany. She'll be 6 in April.
I'm sorry. I'm thinking about her age now. But let's get back to the epiphany, because we have to go to the UK for that.
Yeah.
Westminster Bridge and David Kelly and
Westminster Bridge, David King.
King.
I was on assignment for Vanity Fair two months after Hurricane Katrina, and I'd been pushing them to do a piece on climate change, and Katrina had finally convinced Graydon Carter to go ahead with it. And I was there interviewing David King, who was the chief science advisor. And he said something that none of the scientists here in the United States were saying, which was that climate change, which we had always seen in the 90s as this distant potential threat that could still be prevented if we got our act together and cut emissions. He said, no, that has actually arrived 100 years sooner than we thought. Just say global warming triggered outright climate change 100 years sooner than we thought. Oh, and by the way, the inertia of the climate system, the lag effect of putting carbon up in the atmosphere means that even if we stopped all emissions tonight, the temperatures would not stop rising for another 30 years. So I walked out of his office that day staggered, really, and trying to figure out, wow, what does this all mean? And I decided, okay, I'll walk down to the river and clear my head a bit.
And as I and jump in.
Yeah. You walk past Big Ben there, and I'm just going over the bridge, and I'm trying to come to terms with all this stuff. And, you know, listeners who've been to London know that right there on the other side of the bridge is that amazing, huge Ferris wheel, the London Eye. And as I crossed over towards that, I heard little children who were laughing and shouting as they went up in the air. And it reminded me that, oh, gosh, I'm a dad now, because my daughter was 5 months old then. And in that moment, out of my mouth, unbidden, came the words, Kiara has to live through this. And I think, well, that was when this book was born. I didn't know I was going to write a book yet, but I knew that I had to do whatever I could to try to find a way for her and, you know, the rest of her generation to live through what lay in store. And we didn't even know then exactly what it meant. And a lot of my research and, of course, the scientific investigations over the last 5 years have been refining exactly what it will mean over the next 50 years and more. And then above all, how do we prepare for that?
Well, you were kind of a pioneer, as I indicated, though, in bringing climate change and global warming to public attention. And when you talk about the UK, you know, now let's get this out of the way here, because, you know, you've got a lot of these deniers where climate change is concerned. You write about them.
Right.
British data they point to, which was supposedly manipulated. Mm. You talk about the Global Climate Coalition that just about admitted, really, openly, that global warming existed, but then withdrew that.
Right.
And these deniers have certainly had a lot of effect now. When you talk about, for example, Chicago is going to be like Houston, and you look at Chicago now, they say, ha, you know, what a joke. Look at Chicago. There's no
– yeah.
The weather, the temperatures are lower than they've ever been. Where's the global warming?
Yeah.
You hear that.
Well, they should read some science, you know. They don't want to read science, though. Their minds are made up. And I would just preface this part of the conversation by saying it's only in the United States that we still have to have this part of the conversation, talking about the climate science. And it is only the Republican Party, that is the only major political party in the world, that still disputes this, takes the flat earth position on this. Look at the conservative political parties that are running the governments of Britain, of Germany, of France, and so forth. None of them dispute the climate science. There are arguments about the policies that you implement, how fast we cut emissions, when, who pays for what, but none of them, not one, disputes the science. And why is that? Because every scientific organization in the world, starting with our own National Academies of Sciences, has said repeatedly, man-made global warming and climate change are real, they're happening, and they are extremely dangerous. So, you know, when I get, of course, I hear from these climate cranks a lot when I write my
stories. Actually, at one point you called them criminals, I think, didn't you? Climate deniers? That's pretty...
I say that a crime, well, I quote the chief climate advisor to the conservative government of Germany says this was a crime, meaning we spent 20 years, our government in the United States, and to him, to Washington. Washington has spent 20 years listening to these climate cranks rather than to scientists. And as a result, that's why my daughter's in this trouble, because we did not listen 20 years ago and start to put the brakes on with even some no regrets policies to reduce emissions. You know, and so when people
say
this. We've
done a lot here in California, Mark.
In California, but I'm talking about in the United States, yeah. We are the main obstacle on the international scale. And because of that, China's getting a pass on this. Australia, Canada, all the other big emitters are getting a pass. And so becoming a dad, I am much, much less patient with the deniers, because when they throw this nonsense out about the science, it's like, look at all these scientific organizations that say it. If you still, in the face of that, are saying that it's all a conspiracy, what, are all of them in on the conspiracy? All of those scientists, they're all corrupt, they're all incompetent, all around the world? Give me a break. That's the ravings of a crank.
Well, on bended knee, 20 years ago, you said that part of the problem was the media, lack of coverage where climate change is concerned. Still a problem?
Absolutely. In fact, I've got a piece that just got turned down this morning by the Washington Post, taking the press to task on this. The American media should be embarrassed by their coverage of this. If you looked and judged only from the mainstream media coverage over the last 12 to 18 months, you would think that the climate deniers might have a point. And yet that position has been repudiated, as I said, repeatedly by all of the top scientists. And I think the media, there's two problems there. One is just appalling scientific illiteracy in the journalistic chain of command. Not, I want to emphasize, not my colleagues on the environmental beats. Those reporters know perfectly well that, for example, those emails that were hacked in England. Read the actual emails. They show zero fraud, as three investigations have verified. So there's the scientific illiteracy on the part of the editors and producers. And then there's also this knee-jerk sense that we have to have this false sense of balance, that if there's one climate denier out there, that we have to balance that against the 99.9% of real scientists who say this is a problem.
Let's talk about how to deal with the problem over the next half century, which is really the subject of your book. And it's not necessarily going to be dealt with in any significant way through solar panels or electric cars or green technology, you argue.
Those are essential parts of the problem, but we have to start thinking differently about this problem. For 20 years, we've been thinking, how do we prevent climate change from happening? And that's where solar panels and efficiency and all that come in.
Important, but not key by any means, I think.
Well, I think they're key, but they are only working the first half of the problem, which is turning off the heat before it becomes unsurvivable. But now we've got to deal with the second half of the problem, and that's what HOT is mainly about. What do we do to put in place protections against the impacts that are now inevitable. And here in California, the big one, I think, is going to be water. The snowpacks are going to be not entirely gone by the time Kiara is my age, but by 2050, we're going to have lost most of that snowpack above the Sierra Nevada. That is going to be difficult to adapt to. There are things we can do, but first of all, we've got to realize it's a problem. Let's start working the problem.
Not in California. You talk about drought as being the overriding problem, I mean, globally.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're seeing this now, a terrible drought in the Amazon. Could be pushing the Amazon over the tipping point, drying out the trees there, causing wildfires or facilitating wildfires, I should say. There's a line in the book from a climate water specialist who says, floods kill thousands and droughts kill millions. And us in the media, we tend to pay more attention to the floods because they're more immediate and dramatic. But it's the droughts that really kill.
You've also got the sea level rising as a result of global warming, so there's a lot of attention to it for that reason.
Well, and that's going to be pretty tricky here in the Bay Area. One of my favorite sources in this book, Will Travis, who works here, he gave a presentation to the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission in which he looked at the fact that we're now locked into 3 feet of sea level rise, and he shows what that will mean on this PowerPoint. And it was amazing. It was the one climate presentation I've seen that made you laugh because he said, okay, let's see what it means, 3 feet of sea level. Whoop, SFO, underwater, not just the runways, but also the 101 entrance ramps. And then he says to the audience, he says, well, the solution to that seems pretty simple, fly Oakland. And everybody laughs, but then, oops, maybe not, because the next panel shows, Oakland Airport also underwater. So we're going to have to figure out a way to protect those airports and a lot of other infrastructure.
San Jose Airport?
I don't know. He didn't mention it. So I guess that's probably still relatively safe in the short term.
Talking to Mark Hertzgaard, his new book is Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Let's talk about some places that you talk about that really do give hope and that point to at least ways of dealing with this problem as we move into the next half century. Surprisingly, Africa, Sahel.
Yeah. That's the single most hopeful story to me in the Western Sahel, in Mali and Burkina Faso, Niger. You've got some of the poorest people on earth. These are illiterate farmers who are adapting to climate change, even though they don't know the term, most of them. And they are doing it without the help of big international aid agencies. Largely by relying on traditional indigenous knowledge. And in brief, what they're doing is growing trees, not planting them. I want to make that clear. They're too poor to buy seedlings and to have irrigation and keep those planted trees alive. But what they do instead is they grow trees amidst their fields of sorghum and millet. And the way they do it is fascinating. They use this old, they call it a zai, which is a little half moon shaped irrigation hollow. And they put to try to capture rainfall, but they began to put manure in there. And of course, in cow manure are the seeds of trees. And so eventually you start to see shrubs and bushes and trees
among their crops.
Among the crops. Yeah. Now, in most of the world, a farmer would say, get that out of there, cut it down. But they have left them. And the results have been remarkable. The shade that those trees provide, and above all, the roots go down into the earth and they aerate the soil so that when there is rainfall, that rainfall soaks into the ground rather than flashing off. And we have seen there that underground water tables are rising by 10 and 15 feet, and the productivity of the crops is doubling and tripling. And most gratifyingly, the rates of child malnutrition are falling in those areas. And this has been spread farmer to farmer, village to village, a little bit of outside NGO funding from Germany. But basically, it's one farmer seeing another getting, you know, the oldest story in the book. How did you get that that performance? And so it's now spread across so much of Western Africa, you can literally see it from outer space in the satellite pictures.
But she also sort of dovetails with your argument that if we're ever going to really deal with this thing, we have to do it kind of from the ground up, literally.
Ground up. But top down as well. Governments have got to set a price on carbon. Right now, it is free to pollute. It is free to drive our civilization towards catastrophe. And you don't even have to pay for putting up that carbon. Put a price on it, and that will change immediately.
Well, the Netherlands also has always been kind of a leader in environmental issues of all kinds. And I mean, I remember years ago doing a thing down in Silicon Valley where they were talking about how in Holland they'd have business leaders and political leaders and environmental leaders actually sit down and work out
compromises. At the same table.
Right, yeah, at the same table. You got a 200-year plan out of Holland now with respect to environment.
200 years. It's inconceivable to us. In fact, it was even inconceivable to my editor on the book. First time he saw it, he put in the margin, typo.
He thought
that,
you were,
that was a typo.
Maybe
so
20 years said, or something.
But not a typo. And yes, and the business people are at the table. Why? Because A, they accept the science, and B, they want to know, they're thinking 25 years out for their investments. They want to know, okay, what are the policies going to be here? So they've got a 200-year plan. They are investing about a billion, and equivalent to $1.5 billion U.S. dollars a year to strengthen their river levees, to dramatically fortify their already formidable sea defenses against the North Sea. And I think the most impressive thing, perhaps, is that they are making very tough-minded political decisions, including forcing people to move out of areas that have been deemed too risky or too costly to defend. And it's very striking. They have a great advantage. They have 800 years of working these kinds of problems. And so and they have a society that, imagine that, believes in paying taxes in order to get the collective good. And again, they've been doing that for a long time. They've known that there's no way when you have 70% of your country is 15 feet below sea level rise, below sea level, rather. As an individual, you cannot protect against that. You need a government. And that's going to be one of the real challenges in much of the United States is that, especially in the South, we don't believe in government. We don't believe in taxation. We're like little kids who want to have only ice cream every night for dinner.
On the other hand, as we said before, California has certainly made some strides where greenhouse gas emissions are concerned. And in Seattle, in Chicago, in New York, there's long-term comprehensive plans to deal with flooding, to deal with drought.
Absolutely. If I were Governor Brown, I would do two things on this. I would continue what Governor Schwarzenegger put in place, which is an actual climate change adaptation plan for California. And the second thing I would do is send the people from that office immediately up to King County in Seattle and study what they're doing, because many of the challenges that are facing them also face us. Like us, Seattle and King County get a lot of their water from snowmelt off of the Cascades. Like us, they are a port on the sea that is going to face significant sea level rise. And they have done amazing, amazing things up there in King County. So we can learn a lot from them here in California.
And also learn from Bangladesh. Again, not necessarily a place where you would think the sort of consciousness is primary, but they're weaving these floating gardens actually from hydraulics, and it's all pretty fascinating stuff.
It's amazing. The resilience of poor people is going to serve them well. There's a bit of conventional wisdom in this field that somehow the rich are going to be able to adapt to climate change and the poor will not. And there is a big kernel of truth to that. There is no doubt that the poor countries and the poor people around this world are going to be punished first and worst by climate change. But they're also much tougher in terms of dealing with it and much more resilient at a basic level. I mean, look, in this country, in this society, my God, if we're out of electricity for 6 hours and you don't have your cell phone and you don't have your internet, we're going to fall apart, right? Over there, they know how to deal with tough situations and to make the best of it. As you say, you know, you create floating gardens. A lot of them have shifted from chickens to ducks. Why? Ducks can float.
We're talking again with Mark Hertzgard. His book is Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. David Perlman of the Chronicle reviewed your book. And by the way, got an excellent review in the New York Times. Congratulations on
that
in the Sunday Times. But I'm quoting from David Perlman, you know, the lion of science reporting here in San Francisco, although I think it was Barbara Ehrenreich who said, you're our best reporter. She gave you that accolade.
One of our best reporters.
All right, so here's David Perlman. There's fine reporting on the evidence for global warming in this book, but unfortunately too much of it becomes a polemic, indicting the Bush administration for crimes, eloquently damning the carbon lobby for obstruction, and even, in an irrelevance, convicting the tobacco industry for who knows what.
Well, I would humbly and respectfully,
for producing Al Gore. No, I'm sorry.
I would disagree. You know, I'm not a science reporter like David Perlman, but I am a political reporter. And to me, I see a very clear link between the tobacco and the climate issues, specifically the kind of disinformation campaign that we've seen for 20 years around climate change is very specifically modeled on what the tobacco companies did for so long with their famous motto, doubt is our product. And the people behind the climate change denialism, it's the same man. It's the same scientist, a guy who I outed in that Vanity Fair story 5 years ago, Frederick Seitz, who took $45 million from the tobacco industry in the 70s and 80s to deny that smoking cigarettes cause cancer, or at least to throw up a lot of dust around it and doubt. And then he became the highest ranking climate denier in the 90s, saying, oh, no, there's no reason to think that, man-made climate science is real.
He was in debates we did on there, in fact.
Is that right?
He was the he was the spokesman.
Yeah, so I see that as a pretty direct connection to what's going on now. And unfortunately, the media, once again, is showing such appalling political gullibility to fall for that. It's really embarrassing.
We also have this kind of conflict between mitigation, deep emission cuts, for example, and adaption, which would, you know, have to deal with sea level and sea levies and safeguarding water and food supplies, those kinds of things.
So, right.
I mean, preparing for more intense heat waves particularly. I mean, see some conflict there?
There has
been historically. In terms of where priority ought to be?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a tough one. And I've heard from a lot of activists, and not just me. I mean, the scientists have been working this. They've all been criticized in past years by activists saying, if you're working on adaptation to climate change, you're part of the problem because you are sending this message that we don't have to stop emissions. So let me be clear once more here, as I am clear repeatedly throughout HOT. We have to do both at once. It's no longer enough to turn off global warming through cutting emissions, although it is more urgent than ever, because if you look at what we're already locked into with today's emissions, it's going to be a very steep hill to climb to prepare for that, to prepare for losing most of the snowpack, for example, here in California. So let's stop it before it gets worse. But at the same time, let's realize that we do have to prepare for losing the snowpacks.
Let me invite listeners to join this conversation. In fact, you can do that now if you'd like to ask a question of Mark Hertzgaard or simply come in here with a comment. We welcome your calls. It's toll-free, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786. Again, the number to call is 866-733-6786. You can also join us by email, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And so let's get down to proverbial bottom line here. Where your daughter is concerned, where her generation is concerned, hopeful, despairing, both?
Both. But I have made a conscious...
Which more?
Kind of depends on the day. You know, and I've also made a conscious decision not to give in to despair because I know where that leads, and that leads to paralysis. And even if the odds are only 10 to 1 that we can pull this off, I would fight if the odds were 1,000 to 1. You know, I would give my life for that little girl. And I think most parents feel the same about their kids. So let's stay hopeful. That's how we're going to beat this.
When we return, we hear from you, our listeners. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. Our guest this hour is Mark Hertzgaard. I'm Michael Krasny, an environmental journalist and reporter who is discussing with us his new book, HOT, Living Through the Next 50 Years, writing from the perspective of a father and outlining the changes that he foresees happening in the global environment over the next 50 years, and emphasizing how his now 5-year-old, almost 6-year-old daughter's generation will have to contend with the disruptions of climate change. Mark Hertzgaard will be at the World Affairs Council Wednesday night at 6 o'clock. That's over 312 Sutter in San Francisco. And if you want to find out more about appearances he'll be doing, just go to his website. It's spelled H-E-R-T-S-G-A-A-R-D. The website is markhertzgaard.com. Let's go to your calls. And we begin with Caller from San Rafael. Bill, you're on.
Yeah, it just sickens me to think of the waste of resources, the trillions of dollars that are now going to be diverted into climate change adaptation, basically putting a big bandage on the catastrophe, when obviously the cheapest way to deal with this, with adaptation, is prevention. How do you make that connection to policymakers?
I think policymakers need to be doing both. It's too late to prevent this, but we can certainly keep it from becoming unmanageable, or at least we hope we can keep it from becoming unmanageable, and that means a radical slashing of emissions. And I think for that, it's got to be, we've got to elect different leaders in the Congress. We'd have a climate bill if we had a different House of Representatives and Senate by now. And I think I agree with my colleague Bill McKibben on that, that really it's going to take a grassroots movement.
You with Bill on the 350 number? I mean, that's his whole...
Well, that's what the scientists say. And I think that's true. I think that it's very hard to see how to get there right away. But I think that the number one politician who really needs to be called out on this is Barack Obama. And frankly, I'm
couldn't
baffled.
Couldn't do much in Copenhagen, could he, really?
Well, he didn't come with very much in Copenhagen. I've been surprised at what little political leadership he has shown on this, because here's a guy who in 2008 got elected because millions of young people, most of whom had never been involved in politics before, started working online, knocking on doors, etc., to elect this guy. We know from polling that among young people, climate change is one of their two top issues. If you want to get reelected in 2012, you better deliver something, not just give one or two speeches about it. You better spend some political capital and show some real leadership. And I think that if Obama wants that young people's vote, and especially the activists, the a million or two activists who helped him last time, he better up his game significantly and soon.
Let me thank the caller, and we'll move to more of your calls. We'll go next to Catherine in Sacramento. Hi, Catherine.
Yes, good morning. I would ask Mark what strategy we should presently take with Congress and with our state legislature on the getting a tax on gasoline and on smart growth.
The best idea that I've seen as a policy is this so-called cap and dividend, not to be confused with cap and trade, where that was basically just a shell game for Wall Street. But under cap and dividend, you would cap the amount of carbon that's allowed out into the atmosphere in the same way. But then the money that is gained from that would be given back to the public. Everybody would get a check. And with that check, you could invest in your own energy efficiency or not. You'd be free as a citizen to do what you like. But certainly many, if not most people, would say, okay, with the price of energy, of fossil fuel energy going up, let me invest in solar or energy efficiency in my home, etc. And I think that is a very politically appealing proposal. But that's on the policy realm. I think before you get too much of any of that, what you really need is simply much more grassroots pressure. You've got to show politicians that if they vote the wrong way on this issue, you will vote them out. That's the only thing they understand. And unfortunately, the environmental movement, especially in Washington, the big mainstream groups, they want to be the White House's friend and have what they think of as access, which they confuse with influence. You
also
want a politician to fear you.
They're pretty much run like corporations, aren't they?
Well, there's a lot of that, too. There's a lot of that, too. But, I mean, that's politics 101, to think in Washington that the best idea is going to win. Come on. That's silly. You need a politician to be afraid of you and respect you, not like you.
Can you rally the troops? I mean, Bill McKibben got lots of young people out there. And as you said, Obama, when he was on campaigning, got lots of environmental people out there. Can you still get that sort of grassroots movement? Because a lot of people, you know, global warming and climate change seem kind of like the deficit. You know, they know it's there. But in terms of getting out and doing action to ameliorate the problem, that's a different story.
Yeah, I think that kind of breaks along generational lines, that I've run into very, very few young people who don't care about this, and there's a lot of activism on college campuses. Climate change is by far the leading focus of activism there. And there's something interesting that I've heard of recently. We'll see if it pans out, but there's this group called Kids Against Global Warming, and they are planning a million-person march on Mother's Day called I Matter. as in iPod, iPad, etc. And do I matter to you politicians? They want to put a million kids, not in Washington, but in the 50 state capitals, to demand that politicians and business leaders and others face up to this.
A million in each state capital?
No, among the 50. The 50. I think you'd be hard-pressed in Anchorage to get that.
Or Juneau, I should say. Pretty ambitious. Let me go to more of our callers, and we'll get Grant on next. Hi, Grant.
Hello, Michael. So I'm totally in agreement with Mr. Hertzgard's comments. I think it's important, the recognition of a few things he said. This is a disinformation campaign, and what we really need is an Apollo program, and it's reliant upon the media. Now, when I say that, in 2001, a group of government officials came forward, among them Lord Admiral Hill Norton, a five-star admiral, former British Ministry of Defense head, FAA chiefs, section chiefs, as well as hundreds of them. They're all at the Disclosure Project. You can find it, Disclosure Project. What they're alleging is that in secret, unacknowledged, special access government research projects akin to the Manhattan Project, we've figured out a solution to the climate problem. It comes in part by time variable magnetic interactions and the ability to harness energy from the vacuum. Now, they came forward in 2001 in front of the National Press Club, and to be honest, I'm quite ashamed that a program I hold dear called Forum has not looked into this, because they are alleging the hugest revolution in humankind. It is time for the end of the childhood of the human race. They have come forward specifically because of global climate change. But what they hold is basically the keys to our future, the ability to pull energy seemingly out of nothing.
Let me find out what Mark Hertzgard knows about this.
I've not heard about that.
Neither have I.
I'm happy to go look into it.
Likewise.
But I would say this, that we know how to solve this. Then there's no one solution, vacuum or fusion or anything. There's a lot of different solutions. You probably start, as the caller mentioned, with, I advocate in the book, a green Apollo program of starting with energy efficiency and using the purchasing power of the government. And the thing is, most of these technologies we already have. We have solar, we have wind, we have geothermal. The trick is getting them out and widely dispersed rapidly. And that is where we need more government leadership.
Let me thank the caller. You alluded before to the fact that the United States has kind of set a bad precedent, which I think everyone would agree with in terms of greenhouse gas emissions and so forth. But there's still this problem of the third world, not only the third world, but particularly, China, although, as you point out in your book, they're doing research on large-scale ecological agriculture, and mm-hmm. they've certainly done some innovative things. But China, Brazil, India feel, well, it's our turn, and even if the United States starts cutting back, mm-hmm. they're still going to feel that way. You're still going to have to deal with the fact that they are moving forward, and they believe in the progress of their mm-hmm. sovereign states. And
yeah. Well, it's a complicated picture that we don't always hear enough about here in the United States. China, I think the first Western writer to go to China and write about its environmental catastrophes there for Earth Odyssey in the 90s. So I'm very familiar with them. And yes, they are a climate change superpower just like we are. They're burning way too much coal. But at the same time, they are investing massively in solar, in wind, in energy efficiency. And you mentioned what they're doing in ecological agriculture. So it's a more complicated picture. Brazil, and this is a story that really hasn't gotten the attention it deserves in the United States, at Copenhagen, they came into Copenhagen offering 36% emissions reductions, way, way, way beyond what Barack Obama and even way beyond what Europe was promising. Didn't get covered in the Western press, but they're ready to go. And China certainly sees that that the green economy is the growth field for the 21st century. So I think that if we were to remove the roadblock from Washington and the United States really stepped forward and said, look, we're going to have, to use President Obama's words, if this is our Sputnik moment, let's have a race to the green energy economy. And I think you would see that China and India and Brazil would be very much
on board.
The same line. Oh, absolutely. They're farther ahead than us in some ways.
Here's a listener who writes, I have an unscientific question based purely on observation, as with the human body that perspires when heated and then cools as a result. All this additional CO2 caused planetary heat puts a lot of additional moisture into the atmosphere. Isn't it possible that the actual period of warming may be temporary and replaced by a new chaotic form of global ice age?
Well, it's not what the scientists think. It is certainly true that the temperature rise is making the planet wetter. That's part of the reason that scientists say that we're going to have more extreme downpours and storms and so forth. But they do not expect it to somehow lead to an ice age. That's speculation.
Marjorie, who signs her name as Lake Tahoe Lover, says, what happens to the water level of our beloved Lake Tahoe when the Sierra snowpack is gone?
You have to realize that the snowpack is going to melt gradually, and that's what's going to make it so tricky, is that as it melts, you know, basically that's a water storage system up there that masquerades as snow-capped peaks. And right now what it does is it will start to melt, and we get the water down here in the flatlands in the late spring and summer when we need it to grow crops and to bathe and so forth. And as global warming continues, we're going to see that the water is going to be melting and heading down to the flatlands sooner in the year when we don't need it, and thereby raising the danger of floods. And then it won't be there by June, July, August in the way that we need it. That's the short-term danger. Long before Tahoe goes dry, that's what we're going to have to really pay attention to.
Talking again with Mark Hertzgard. His book is Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Let me go to a few more emails before I go to more of your calls. Robert writes, I've heard that global warming will have winners and losers. Won't some people and species benefit from the warming?
Definitely will have winners and losers, and that's exactly the phrase that was used by by Ron Sims, the county executive up in King County, for why he's trying to adapt King County, because he says, I want us to be a winner in the future, and people are going to want to move here, and businesses will want to move here. Why? Because we're going to have a city that works. We're going to have levees that prevent floods, etc. So, yes, it is true, to get to the caller's specific concern, that there will be some places and species that may benefit temporarily. You can talk there, for example, about Canada. I think that British Columbia, for example, they're going to be able to start growing wine there. You might even be able to see parts of Russia that will be able to have longer growing seasons. But again, it's not so simple. The soils in Canada, the soils in Siberia are not so good. We want to be growing food in the Midwest. Why? Because those are some of the most productive soils on the planet. And if we move the temperature bands up higher, it's not like you can just say, oh, we'll just move the fields up to Alberta. Not going to work.
Well, they're also our breadbasket. I mean,
exactly.
Talking about the
reality. You don't want to deplete the breadbasket.
Here's Preston. It says, hello, I was wondering if your guest could also speak about possible cooling and strengthening of storms. This recent cold front in the Southwest reached far into Mexican growing regions, and as a result, there's been devastating vegetable crop loss.
Yes, that's correct. And this is, again, an example of extreme weather. And it's why people have to realize we have entered into this second era where climate change has begun. And climate
change. I almost want to retire global warming because, you know.
Except,
I mean,
that's
a lot
also
of lay people. Yeah, no, but a lot of lay people, they don't. I mean, and I think there are some environmental scientists who agree with you. Absolutely, who think that maybe the language is a problem, because global warming suggests in some people's minds that things are continuing to get warmer and warmer when climate change is bringing cold fronts too.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the language, Michael, because unfortunately, and it's probably too late to change it now, but the language around this issue has been devised by two of the worst possible groups of people who could do it, scientists and lawyers. And so you get global warming and climate change. And what the heck does that actually mean?
We need what the linguists call new signifiers is what we need.
A new signifier. I'm down with that.
Well, are you down with this? Michael writes, what does Mark think about a regional gas tax and a regional Bay Area goal of reducing our regional GHG output by 25% by 2020?
I think that's very worth studying as part of a larger regional pact, which we've already got begun to reduce greenhouse emissions between us, I should say, among us and the states of Oregon and Washington. And when Schwarzenegger was governor, he even began discussions with the British about trying to have a joint system of greenhouse gas emissions reductions through taxes and so forth, cap and dividend, whatever. And it's what's interesting, there's a number of regions that are doing this here and in the Northeast. And we talked earlier, Michael, about how Washington's such a roadblock. But gosh, When you look at all the regions and cities around the world, starting here in California.
I think the hope is with the state and the local governments.
Exactly. I mean, we're the eighth largest economy in the world. What we do here is almost, not quite, but almost more important than what Washington does. And so I think anything that can get us out there. And by the way, our capitalists understand this. The Silicon Valley guys, there's a reason that so much of the money that went against last November, the Prop 19, that money came out of Silicon Valley. And why? Because they see, as well as the Chinese and the Germans do, that the export markets of the future, now and going forward, are green technology. Let's not be left behind.
And we won't leave behind our callers. In fact, Holly, join us. You're next up. Good morning.
Perfect. Well, the discussion of Silicon Valley is the perfect segue. Hi, Mark. Congratulations on yet another excellent book, and Michael, another excellent show.
Thank you.
I wanted to have Mark address the role of business in helping slow climate change, climate instability. What specific recommendations do you have for small, medium, and Fortune 500 businesses in this country and the various different kinds of associations that represent them to, one, help really promulgate policies we didn't get through the last time, and also via existing policies like the huge amount of money in the Farm Bill and the transportation bills, which are bills we will definitely have.
I'm glad you brought this up, Holly. Excuse me, I was just going to mention President Obama talking today to the Chamber of Commerce and talking about business. Mm-hmm. I wonder if he'll bring up some of these environmental issues that we're touching upon.
Right. Well, the business community is not a monolith. The Chamber of Commerce has been absolutely dreadful on this issue. They have been some of the main perpetrators of this disinformation campaign. But at the same time, there are many, many good corporate citizens out there, many of them located here in California, who are doing exactly what Holly is urging, which is to really try and shift the dial in this direction. I'd say that there's two or three things that specifically should be done. One is to continue political lobbying. Speak out. If you're a business, speak out within your business association and within the public debate so that this nonsense that circulates courtesy of the Chamber of Commerce and Fox TV and the Wall Street Journal editorial page, this nonsensical idea that somehow fighting climate change is bad for the economy. The truth is that the only thing that's going to save the economy is to go green and to fight climate change. So businesses need to speak out as responsible corporate citizens and try and change the political conversation. They should also be lobbying in that direction to increase the government support for these things. And then, of course, here in California in particular, let's reach out and do the kind of I don't think Silicon Valley needs my advice on how to capture these markets. What they need is responsible public policy that will reinforce their desire. We've got innovation out the wazoo here. Let's find a way to get it out into the marketplace. And that means changing the policies both in Sacramento, where they've been pretty good but can always accelerate, and especially back in Washington.
Well, Daryl Issa, who actually was overseeing the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, he's chair of that committee, said that EPA rules dominate. And in fact, he released today a statement from more than 160 companies, industry trade associations, conservative think tanks, asking about whether regulations harm jobs. And guess what the answer was? In most cases, yes.
Well, I'd be curious to see the list of those 160. You know, these people want to go after the EPA now, despite, once again, look at the real data. EPA regulations have saved this economy tens of billions of dollars purely in productivity, not to mention how many human lives have been extended or saved by keeping pollutants out of our air and water. So I think, again, this is one of the things that if you're a business person and you want to be responsible on this, stand up for the EPA.
We haven't talked about geoengineering. I want to get to that for a moment because there are a number of proposals, pretty controversial proposals, that involve intervention via technology in the climate system itself.
Mm-hmm. The idea of geoengineering is to not just reduce the emissions that are ongoing, but rather to go up and take out carbon dioxide, especially, that's already in the atmosphere, find a way to take it out and thereby reduce the greenhouse effect and presumably lower temperatures. And some of the ideas they have for
doing
this.
Some are promising, are they not?
Well, there's some possibilities. You know, I know a lot of enviros are sort of instinctively against this, and I think it's certainly one has to be extremely careful.
They're against recombinant DNA for the same kinds of reasons,
right,
aren't they?
Right. And there have been some really wacky ideas like putting iron filings in the ocean. And one must certainly say that let's not do this lightly, because we could very easily make things worse. And a lot of very serious scientists who care a lot about climate change, that's the first thing they say. But they also say, second, let's research further so that we can make a more informed decision about this, not just knee-jerk rejection or embrace.
On we go to more of your calls, and we welcome Art. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much for an excellent show and letting me speak. Mark, am I the only one that's proposing dropping the speed limit to 55 miles an hour, or is that a way-out idea?
I don't think it's a way-out idea. I'm old enough to remember when the federal government ordered that in the late 1970s when I was first starting to drive, because you save a lot of gasoline that way. It also tends to be a heck of a lot safer. You reduce fatalities and injuries on the roads. I think it will be a tough sell to people, but there's going to be a lot of things that are going to be a tough sell in the years to come. You know, we don't have any good choices anymore on this fight. It's going to be a selection among choices that are less good and outright horrible. And in terms of driving 55, I think that's not a bad place to start. But above all, let's drive less.
Again, our guest is Mark Hertzgard. His book is Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. And the man walks the walk and talks the talk. Came over here by bike this morning, right?
I did. Bicycle.
Okay. Just bicycle. Want to mention that. And we'll go to another caller, and that's Rebecca. Hi.
Hi. We were just up in the Sierras. We finally got the kids to the snow, and coming back, we just saw so many cars just going and going and going. And I thought, nobody's getting this message. So how about for the language, how about we propose or just use the term climate chaos? It has a lot more punch. Global warming sounds like a warm bath, and I think people kind of think that sounds good, you know. So maybe we need to refer to the chaos that's going on.
I think climate chaos is an excellent term, and in fact, I tried that out on John Schellenhuber, who we've referenced earlier in the show. He's a physicist and the former chief climate advisor to the conservative government of Germany. And I said, what do you think about this term climate chaos? And he said, that's actually a very good term. And it turns out that his original scientific work was in chaos theory.
I was just going to say, the connection of chaos theory is obvious.
He's in chaos theory, and he says that's what the average person still doesn't get about this. They think that climate change is going to be gradual, and that's not what the historical record shows, that the
just
climate
that
change
butterfly,
is
butfly, right? That one butterfly.
Right.
The difference.
Right.
I always wonder where that butterfly is.
Where is he today?
Talking again with Mark Hertzgard. Talk about cars, though. I mean, you know, I can't tell you how many programs I've done through the years about commuting and about decreasing the carbon imprint through people. And you go in any commute hour of the day or on the weekend, and the flow of traffic is so dominated by people alone in their cars.
Yeah, I feel
and
so.
And not using public transportation and not being on bicycles, but I'm just talking about people driving alone.
Yeah. I have a lot of sympathy for them, because I don't have to do that or choose to do it, perhaps. And I think I live a much calmer, happier life as a result. And while I think everybody's personal choices have to be their own and they have responsibility for them, let's also bear in mind the social context here. Because our government in this state and in this nation for 50, 60 years now has focused on a car-centered approach to transportation, you now have a situation where if you want to have a job, it's very difficult in many parts of the country to get there without a car. So this is another thing that King County, Washington has done so brilliantly with their new housing development, the Greenbridge Housing Development. Let's change our infrastructure and how we plan communities so that you don't need a car, so that you have access to real, reliable mass transit. I think it's all to the good, for example, that Muni now has, when you go down to the bus stop, you can see, oh, the 5 bus is coming in 2 minutes, or the 16 is going to come in 10 minutes. All of that makes mass transit a much more user-friendly experience, and hopefully that will lead to increased usage. But eventually, you've got to tackle sprawl.
Well, you mentioned the social context. I mean, for example, all this talk about smart growth and everything really ties in with ways of presumably against the future in the next 50 years, at least dealing with the kinds of problems we've been talking about. But you need – you point out this, and we said it before, bottom-up citizen-driven government action. But everything gets down to, in so many ways, questions of social context and social structures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I love New Orleans and I love Louisiana, but they are, on the one hand, I mean, they're the poster child for what can happen under climate change, where you get these, you know, mega storms like Hurricane Katrina. And on the other, even today, they are so dependent in that state, or perceive themselves as so dependent on oil and gas, that their elected representatives, the governor and the two senators, one Republican, one Democrat, none of them are voting for climate legislation. The state did not have a building code prior to Hurricane Katrina. Why? Well, that's socialistic. That's planning. That's a communist thing. You know, that kind of thinking is just not compatible with survival in the new era of climate change.
We're talking again with Mark Hertzgaard and discussing his new book, Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years. Again, Wednesday night, you can actually meet Mark. He'll be at 312 Sutter in San Francisco at the World Affairs Council. What are you doing next? What's next project?
Well, I'll be at the Commonwealth Club. And
reporting, you're writing, you're journalism.
Oh, well, I have another book idea I'm not ready to discuss yet, but the other big journalistic piece I want to do is on peak oil, because I think that is almost as urgent as climate change, and in some ways even more short term, because we're so dependent on oil in particular for our transportation system, and we are so close to if we haven't already met peak oil, we're very close to it, and that is going to be really. If you think you've seen difficulties to date, wait till you can't find gasoline for your car.
I have to also ask you, when you say you don't want to talk about the next book, is it superstition? I've got another book in mind, and
not
I think I'm kind of protecting it at the same time that I'm superstitious.
Well, I know it's a good idea. I want to keep it to myself for the moment.
Yeah, but you also can talk it out, you know, and then you don't have to write.
Not in front of 80,000 people. I'm not going to talk it out.
Good to have you on, Mark. Thank
Always
you.
Always good, Michael.
Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, Mark Hertzgaard. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. And tomorrow we'll be talking with Evan Bolin in this hour, famed Irish poet and Stanford professor. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.